On Cyril Spinetta denounced the strike, saying it would cost the company $125 million. Spinetta told French radio, "They're just opening the door to our competition, who will rush right in." Flight attendants have threatened to join pilots in their walkout on Monday, causing further disruptions. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
Computer technology company Sun Microsystems is one of the latest to announce major cutbacks due to the faltering economy. Sun is a leading supplier of computer services, servers, workstations, and memory devices. Sun says it is going to cut up to 18% of its workforce over the coming year. That amounts to somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 workers. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
Good morning. I'm Stephen Lyons, a member of the National Book Critics Circle and guest host for Focus 580, sitting in for David Inge. Unless you've been absent from the planet during the last 20 years or have not been in a Walmart, Lowe's, or Menards during those same two decades, you probably already know about China's booming economy. Walmart alone imports more from China than the entire country of Canada imports from China, as Robin Meredith points out in her book about the Chinese and Indian economies, The Elephant and the Dragon. We also owe China quite a bit of money, as you may have heard in recent weeks. Boom times can be hard on the planet, environmentally certainly, socially as well. Yet the combined growth of China and India during the past two decades has cut the portion of the world living in extreme poverty from 40% to 20%. 350 people will be lifted out of extreme poverty. Not a bad thing at all. Books are flying off the presses in recent years, analyzing the galloping economies of Asia. But we have yet to have an intelligent book emerge that drills down to the individual behind the dragon, if you will. A book that profiles the millions of Chinese who work in the raging and belching factories of South China that make just about everything we purchase here in the United States. The millions of people who work, mostly without governmental controls and union protection, inadequate health care, 13-hour days, 7 days a week, for a fraction of what we would call a fair wage. Who are these workers? What do they look like? Where do they come from? What are their dreams and aspirations? What are the risks and rewards? Thanks to journalist Leslie T. Chang, we now have such a book. Ms. Chang, a former correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, spent 3 years in China trying to find answers to those questions. She found that the largest human migration in human history is now underway in China. Since the 1970s, 130 million people are migrating from rural towns and villages to toil in roaring industrial cities. 70% are female, and many are teenagers. Her new book is Factory Girls, published by Spiegel & Grau. The New York Times calls Ms. Chang's reporting an exceptionally vivid and compassionate depiction of the day-to-day dramas and the fears and aspirations of the real people who are powering China's economic boom. I call it another shining example of our country's golden era of nonfiction narrative reporting. Let me remind listeners that we recorded this interview earlier in the week, so we will not be taking phone calls this morning. Leslie T. Chang, thank you for being with us, and welcome to Focus 580.
Hi, thank you.
Why did you write this book? What was your intentions?
Well, I'd actually been working as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in China for a number of years and kind of casting about for a topic that would sort of dig deeper, you know, because as a reporter in China, you're sort of overwhelmed by all the stories you're writing. You could spend 10 years there and never really understand anything very well. So I started noticing that a lot of the foreign newspapers, including my own, had done stories about conditions inside Chinese factories. And I started to become curious about, you know, what factory life looked like to a young person from the countryside. I thought it must look quite different than how it does to a foreign reporter. So I went down to a huge factory city called Dongguan in South China, and initially I just spent a few days sort of hanging out on the streets talking to young women as they got off their shifts. And within a few days, I realized that there was an amazing story to be told and probably a book that I could write about this place.
You say the 130 million migrants are the rural elite, and 70% are women, and you call it the largest migration in human history. How does a young man or woman go about migrating to a manufacturing area? What is the bridge to
Yeah, usually, you know, it's in China, there's a phrase, mang liu or liu dong ren kou. These phrases mean a blind wave or the floating population. That's how the city people refer to migrant workers, which suggests that it's sort of a chaotic, blind mass of people. And one of the things I learned was that it's not that way at all. Usually someone will go out from a village in the company of an older sister or brother or a cousin or a fellow villager, somebody who already knows something about the city and can introduce them into a factory. So there's actually a very strong, though informal, network across the country that helps these young people come out from home.
What is the implications for the villages that are left sort of depeopled of the young?
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the really striking things as you travel around rural China is that, you know, in the fields, it's usually an old person, an old man or an old woman farming. And in the villages, there's either older people or young children who are still in school. Everyone who's in that middle generation, you know, from age 17 to age 40, you know, basically is out working in the cities, either far away in these factory towns or sometimes in the cities or towns closer to home doing kind of small-scale business and trade. So, you know, there's a huge depopulation of rural China. But I don't think that, you know, there's been a lot of alarmist things, you know, like who will feed China, who's going to farm. And the reality is that there were basically too many people living in rural China because of the Communist Party system of keeping people in rural China and only the elite were allowed to live in the cities under the Mao years. So basically there's far too many people in rural China for the work that's available. So I think all these young people coming out from home is kind of redressing this population imbalance that has been in place over decades.
And I would imagine you would say that the economic boom currently underway in China could not be carried on without these young people, without their energy.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, one of the amazing things about being in Dongguan, this factory town, was that every single person I met there was a migrant. You know, everyone in the factory from the lowest worker on the factory floor up through mid-level management to the high-level people were all people who had come from rural China. And, you know, one big reason is that these are really tough jobs and people who've grown up in the cities are accustomed to a more cushy lifestyle. They don't want these jobs, so it's left for the rural people to take them.
Well, set the physical and environmental scene of cities such as Dongguan, this mess of mega factories in the subtropics of southern China where you did most of your reporting. You say there's maybe 10 million people in all, mostly migrants.
Yeah. It's just kind of this endless sprawl. There's no sense that the city has developed in any sort of organized way. Just row after row, street after street of factories. You know, when you're in the city at the time that the factories let off workers around, say, 6 p.m., 6 in the evening, it's suddenly there's just floods of young people, you know, just teenagers, 16 and 17-year-old girls and big packs and couples. And you kind of feel like you're in this massive, you know, open high school of only teenagers, and like those are all the people in the world. It's very polluted, as many large cities in China are. It's very loud. It's very chaotic. There's a lot of traffic. One thing that's striking is there's almost no presence of government. You know, in most Chinese cities, everywhere you go, you'll see, you know, courthouses and Communist Party offices. And here in Dongguan, you'll just walk everywhere and sort of not see any presence of government. And I think this is really telling because it's really a city that's run by the factories. It's a purely economic, completely non-political kind of place, basically.
So if you were robbed on the streets or had some crime committed against you, where would you go?
You probably wouldn't really go anywhere.
Okay.
You know? If it happened, you know, there's a lot of petty crime that takes place. If it happens to be in an area you know, maybe you could call on your friends to come help you and try to track down the person. But other than that, you know, I heard so many stories of people being robbed and, you know, the police were never really in evidence. You know, not, you know, like people didn't go to the police and then the police weren't really present in most cases. So it was a very strong sense that you're really on your own here.
And what happens if you're injured? Same thing?
No, if you're injured, you can, I mean, there are hospitals and clinics, mm-hmm. You know, there isn't much health insurance in China, especially for people who aren't in, you know, really solid jobs. So you'd have to pay everything out of pocket up front. You know, if you don't pay your cash up front, they don't let you in. They don't give you a bed or anything. But yeah, if you're injured, and that's most likely what you would do, go to a hospital and pay money to get treated. But again, you know, for the workers, there's very little job security. So if someone was injured on the job, most likely, you know, depends on the factory, but a better factory might pay them a few thousand yuan, which is, you know, a few hundred dollars, and just send them home. There isn't any sort of guarantee that they'll help you get better and keep your job for you, anything like that.
You talk about 32 towns divided into manufacturing specialties, Nokia, Reebok, Nike, Nescafe, Pioneer, Samsung, and, of course, Karen Electronics. And 70% female. Why is that? Why such a female workforce when often we've heard that female babies are not exactly welcome?
Yeah. Well, Dongguan was kind of an interesting place for me, and that's one of the reasons I chose it, is because it has so many of these labor-intensive factories, it particularly drew young women. And the reason is that the factory bosses prefer young women because they feel like they're more diligent and they're more painstaking and they're less likely to drink and get into fights and form gangs and make a lot of trouble. So Dongguan was striking in that way, in that there's a, you know, very heavy female population. But actually across the country, migration is a huge phenomenon among both women and men. And nationally, it's probably, you know, more than half the people are men. It's just that in the factories, the women are intensely concentrated.
Mm-hmm. I want to read from your book. The chapter is called To Die Poor is a Sin, page 55. The stories of migrant women shared certain features. The arrival in the city was blurry and confused and often involved being tricked in some way. Young women often said they had gone out alone, though in fact they usually traveled with others. They just felt alone. Can you talk about that a little bit? About, I mean, these women who are coming in, these young girls really from rural China, they must be very inexperienced. I would assume somewhat naive. And how do they avoid the pitfalls of being taken advantage of?
Yeah, well, I think their initial experience in the city is often one of being tricked and taken advantage of. You know, when I talked to, you know, I ended up writing about the stories of two young women mainly, but I ended up talking to, you know, dozens of young women, and usually the initial story they came out from home and they were tricked into working in a really bad factory that had really terrible conditions, or someone introduced them to a factory and it turned out not to be at all what they expected. You know, one of the two young women I write about, Chun Ming, soon after she came out from home, she was almost tricked into working as a massage girl in a you know, very dicey kind of parlor, possibly a brothel, and she had to escape from that and sort of make her way. So I think the initial encounter, as you say, they are very naive, they're very ignorant about the city, and they are often frequently tricked. But that was one of the reasons I wanted to get to know some people and follow their lives over time, because I think when you first meet someone who's just come out, it's a really dire story. They're often working in a terrible factory in really poor conditions. But as you watch them grow and learn over months and years, you know, you see that they have the ability to move out of these situations and even move into kind of this proto-middle class type lifestyle, which is what I found in both of the young women I wrote about.
Mm-hmm. And the conditions and the hours, the typical pay, can you describe that for our listeners?
Yeah, I reported in Dongguan between about 2004 and 2006. So at that time, for young women first coming out from home, it might be, you know, work 7 days a week for, you know, 13 or 14 hours a day. Never a day off, just day after day, week after week, maybe one day off a month if the factory had to shut off for half a day or something. And the wages, probably like a reasonable wage would be maybe 600 yuan a month, which at that time was about $75. But for a young woman coming out, her first job might pay considerably less than that, you know, maybe even 300 yuan or, you know, half of that, maybe $30 or $40 a month. Those numbers have gone up a little bit since then. I'd say now kind of an average wage in Dongguan is maybe $110, $120 a month. But I think the overall feeling is the same, in that when they first come out, the job that they find is really terrible. But then gradually they hear, not even gradually, quite quickly, they hear about, you know, this job is better, this one pays on time, this one lets you have one day off a week, and then the people gradually gravitate towards those better factories.
Is that enough money to live on?
Surprisingly, it is, because, you know, the cost of living in these towns is really, really cheap, and most of the workers, especially the young ones who are unmarried, they'll live in dorms. So let's say you're making 600 yuan a month. The food is almost nothing. The food is maybe 30 or 40 yuan a month that you're paying the factory for the cafeteria food. And then the dorm is maybe another 50 or something. So basically, you're making about 500 yuan a month, and it depends on how you want to spend it. Mostly, a lot of these young women send, you know, the bulk of the money they make home to support their families, younger children who are still in school. But sometimes women will just set up bank accounts and save the money themselves, looking towards their own futures when they're going to be getting married and needing the money for themselves. So even though the pay sounds really low and is really low, the cost of living is also really low. So it is possible to save money and rise up over time if you're motivated and careful about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind our listeners that this interview was recorded earlier in the week, and we will not be taking phone calls, of course, because we are not live as you're listening to this. Why is the pay often late? I mean, if these factories are booming and money and capital is coming in, why is it so hard to pay the workers?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think it could be a mix of reasons. You know, in some cases, often factories are, you know, not run under the most rational and orderly way. So maybe they're often overstretched and they just don't have the cash on hand to pay. In many cases, it's just, you know, the bosses are quite whimsical and they don't treat the workers well at all. So it's just not really their concern that they're paying exactly on the same day, even if, of course, the workers are counting on this pay because, you know, especially if they've sent their money home, they're living on the few yuan that they've saved for themselves, and they're sort of waiting every day for payday. But, you know, it's the power balance is definitely against the workers. But one of the things I did notice was that even though the workers are so powerless, they use every means they have to try to improve their situations and improve their employability, basically.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there are fines for talking. There are bathroom breaks are regulated. You write that getting into a factory was easy. The hard part was getting out. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, there's a very common practice of the factories is to hold the first 2 months of a worker's pay. So if you get into a factory in May, say you work in May and June, you won't get your first paycheck until July. And the reason they do that is so that a worker can't leave without approval, because if you leave without approval, then you're not going to get your 2 months salary back. So I met many workers who hated their jobs but were not willing to leave because that meant giving up a huge chunk of salary. On the other hand, you know, one of the initial experiences of Min, the young woman I write about, was that, you know, she started off in this really terrible factory, and her boss held 2 months of her pay. And after 6 months of working this horrible place, you know, 14 hours a day, no days off, terrible pay, she went to her boss and said, you know, I hate your factory. I don't want to work here anymore. I want approval to leave. And the boss said no. But, you know, the next day she went back and she said, I still want to leave. And the boss said, well, wait till Chinese New Year, and if you still want to leave, then I'll give you your money back then. And so that's what she did. You know, she waited a few months, and when the holiday came around, she went back to her boss, and her boss gave the 2 months' pay back, which allowed her to leave. And, you know, that was really interesting. I heard that story from her really early, and it made me see that, you know, even though these workers seem so powerless and so exploitable, that they really, you know, through sheer will, they can actually get some things done. You know, of course, there are still many injustices, but that they can get things done and try to make things work their way.
Do you think Min was, and I want to talk to her, talk about her. I'd love to talk to her, actually. She sounds fascinating. Do you think she is a typical factory girl? I mean, to me, she had incredible initiative and spunk and was willing to, as you say, talk to her first boss and say, I hate you. I hate your job. I'm out of here. It doesn't sound very compliant at all. It doesn't sound like, you know, she was a typical worker.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, these young girls and boys, they're really tough. You know, they've mm-hmm. grown up in poverty in rural China. They've lived in really tough conditions on the farm. And, you know, they've basically been going to school. Often they board away from school from the time they're quite young. That's a very common tradition in China. So they've basically, you know, they're used to being on their own. They realize that they're on their own. And if they don't speak up, no one's going to speak up for them. So this sort of stereotype we might have about, you know, Confucian, you know, conformity mm-hmm. and compliance, you know, I didn't really find that so much among these young people, precisely because they knew that if they didn't speak up, you know, they probably weren't going to survive in the city. In terms of how typical Min was, you know, it was very important to me that the people I wrote about had very typical backgrounds, and both Min and Chun Ming came from very typically poor rural villages in the interior of China, and had both had, you know, some kind of middle school or a little bit of high school education, so not at all, not very well educated, but kind of medium educated. But in both cases, I was drawn to them because they were very talkative and curious and interested in me and talking to me. And, you know, in that sense, maybe they weren't that representative, but I also knew realistically, you know, if the people I'm writing about aren't interested in my project and in getting to know me, there's probably no way I'm ever going to be able to stay in touch with them, because there's so much mobility in this, in the city of Dongguan. You know, if you don't call up someone, you know, in a month or two, you've like lost all touch with them, because often they change their cell phone numbers, they'll move to a different dorm, they'll move to a different factory, and there's no way to ever find them again. So a big part of what I was looking for in choosing my subjects was also people who were interested in talking to me and staying in touch with me. That was the only way this project could ever work.
Mm-hmm. And Min came to Karen Electronics when she was 16. Mm-hmm. And I guess she turned 17 a week later. She was making $50 a month, and then the next job she was hired for her penmanship, of all things, mm-hmm. at Yidong Electronics, and she made $100 a month. And she had a life plan that you write about. I wonder if you could tell our listeners about her life plan.
Yeah, it was really interesting. The first time I met her, as you said, she had just turned 18 when I met her, so
18,
she'd been in the
okay.
city just over a year. And I said, well, what's your plan? And she said, I want to work in the city for 7 years and send money home to my parents, and that will repay them for the gift of raising me to adulthood. And then after that, when I'm 23 years old, I'm going to go home and find someone to marry. And I was like, wow, that's a pretty detailed life plan, you know. But, I, you know, I noticed over the 2 years that I spent getting to know her and watching her change that, you know, this plan sort of just, you know, dropped out of sight, and eventually she just stopped mentioning it, you know. And that's another thing. I mean, just the... their expectations, of course, are changing as their lives are changing, and how they see the experience in the city changes as their life changes. You know, often initially when they come to the city, they'll say, you know, my family's really poor, I want to make some money. But then after a while, you'll start hearing them say things like, I want to learn new skills, it's important to see the world, I want to be a modern person. You know, so their kind of expectation and their goal changes to something more abstract and more about self and transformation, and not just a purely material goal as it was maybe when they first came out.
Mm-hmm. The village she came from, you describe it as, well, no, not that village. Describe the village she came from.
Yeah, she came from a small farming village in Hubei province, which is kind
right.
of in south central China, a landlocked province. And there were maybe 90 families in the village, and most of them were related to her. Most of them had her last name, Liu. And and she, you know, she grew up in this village. It was mostly subsistence farming, growing rice and some fruits and vegetables for consumption. So, you know, kind of a typical poor farming village. And she was somewhat unusual in that she came from a family of 5 children. She was the second of 5 children. And, you know, as you know, China has a policy of limiting most mm-hmm. families to 1 child. But in the countryside, that is enforced very spottily and very differently from region to region. And it was really interesting because I went with Min to her village for the Lunar New Year 1 year. And I was talking to her father, and I said, oh, you know, are you... that's interesting, you have 5 kids, you know, do you have the most kids of anyone in the village? And he said, no, actually, our neighbor has 6.
And oh, my goodness.
There's another guy down the road who has 7, and he was the party secretary. So, you know, it was such a great example of how, you know, these policies that you hear about are often implemented very differently when you get down to the very local level, places, the backwaters where people seldom go, you know.
And Lisa, you're fluent in Chinese, I take it.
Yes.
And I'm sure that aided you greatly in your reporting.
Yeah. I think it would be really hard. I mean, I guess certain stories are possible to do through a translator, but, you know, part of this whole reporting project was getting really close to some of these young women, and, you know, I count them as my good friends. You know, we talk about a lot of things. There are certain things they told me that I didn't write about because I knew they were very personal and I wanted to protect them. And, you know, I think it would be impossible to develop this kind of relationship if I couldn't speak with them directly, definitely.
The other main contact you had was Wu Qingming. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yes.
And she was older than Min. She migrated from the Hunan province when she was 17, but back in 1993, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You describe her job history this way. Started out in a toy factory, was almost tricked into a brothel, talked her way into management, and struck it rich selling Tibetan medicine and funeral plots. I guess she got involved in direct sales, too, later on.
Mm-hmm.
How and where did you meet her, and what attracted her to you?
Yeah, I was. I had already met Min, and I was sort of following her story, and I thought it would be interesting to meet an older woman who is not married, and I wondered what sort of pressures they were under from their families to get married and have children, but then also, you know, how their own characters had developed living on their own in the city for so long. So I actually discovered that Dongguan had some dating agencies, and I went to visit one of them, and I said, can I sit in on one of your, you know, gatherings? And they said, sure, and they had no idea what I was doing. So I just went on a Sunday afternoon, and there were all these. It was really funny because, you know, one of the things I was really interested in a place like Dongguan was how these Western and modern, so-called modern ideas are translated and played out in this kind of backwater city like Dongguan. So it was really interesting when they did the dating service. They didn't have a thing where people could just look through the binders and then call up someone and ask for a date because people were too shy to do that. They felt like that was too direct and you know, crass. So instead they had this huge gathering of, you know, 50 men and women who would all stand up and introduce themselves. And then afterwards, the organizer would say, okay, now you can go approach anyone you like. And everyone just sat there, like, staring at each other. You know, it was just, like, the most awkward thing ever. But so I went to this gathering, and I thought it was really interesting. And one woman stood up at this gathering, and she said, I have come here today because I want to give myself more opportunities. Mm. And, you know, I thought that was just a really nice, interesting way of putting it, her visit to a dating agency. So afterwards, after the gathering, I went up to her and talked to her. And this was Qingming, and I just found that she was very lively and strong-willed and interesting. So that's how I met her, and we became friends, and I got to know her story.
Her letters and her journals and sayings are fascinating. I'm looking at them here. She would write things such as, I have no time to be unhappy because there are too many things I want to do. Time is life. We can be ordinary, but we must not be vulgar. Right now I have nothing. My only capital is that I am still young. Can it really be that on this road of life I am destined to be defeated? I don't believe it. I absolutely don't believe it. I found these sayings, Leslie, just so simple but beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, that was one of the most amazing things about Qingming was that, you know, after I got to know her a little bit, she mentioned that when she first came out to the city, she had kept a diary. And then I said, oh, can I see this diary? And then she took me back to her apartment, and there was this shelf, and this long shelf just lined with these little pastel-colored notebooks, one after the other. And then over time, I borrowed them in batches and, you know, read them and made copies of the pages I found really interesting. And, you know, one of the things that comes through so strongly, as you notice, is the sense of kind of like almost like this American self-help, you know, like these aphorisms and inspirational slogans that are supposed to like lead you on the path to prosperity and happiness, you know. And, you know, that was another example of how these American ideas are sort of, you know, imported to a place like Dongguan and sort of undergo these strange and subtle changes. You know, a lot of her notebook sayings have been copied out of, you know, Ben Franklin's autobiography, but it was very bizarre. You know, she'd be like, did you know Ben Franklin was a vegetarian? said, no, I didn't know that. Oh, yeah, yeah, he was a great vegetarian. And then he invented the light bulb and, you know, sort of these very quirky views of American history. So I read these diaries, and it was really moving, and it really charted how she was growing as a person, because originally the diary was full of, you know, this month I'm going to make 300 yuan, I owe this person 120, then I'm going to buy a watch for 30 yuan because I must make better use of my time, you know, like these meticulous catalogs of her money. And then gradually, as she starts moving up from the assembly line, the nature of the diary changes, and she starts writing about how, you know, you must speak in a softer voice, or you must look like an elegant professional woman, and, you know, all these rules about etiquette, how to do your eyebrows, how to eat with a knife and fork. And it's sort of like she's sort of molding herself into this, middle-class, urban, professional person. It was really fascinating to watch her transformation through her diaries.
And I loved your description of another one of her many, many jobs as practicing journalism as extortion. I think we have some examples of that in the United States, actually. The idea of paying journalists for good news, or at least paying them not to say the truth, I guess is another way to put it. What was this job she had?
Yeah, no, it was great. This was after she had spent some years working in pyramid schemes and made a lot of money, but then the government cracked down on them, so she had to find another job. So she found a job at a newspaper that was run by the Customs Bureau. And her modus operandi was to go to a local businessman and say, my paper wants to print a story about you. And the businessman would know that this newspaper was under the Customs Bureau, and so if he didn't treat her well, he might have trouble getting his goods through customs. So he would pay her a chunk of money to write a positive story about his company. And this was how she operated for about a year. And when she told me it wasn't at all like this is bad or whatever, she was like, yeah, it was a good business. I got a lot of commissions, and then I had a fight with my boss, so I had to leave. You know? And that was another thing that in Dongguan is just the corruption was just so endemic and so accepted. And there wasn't any real sense of, you know, this is wrong, but I have to do it. There wasn't really any justification. It was just like, this is how things work, and if you want to work here, you have to do it, you know, and that was the end of it. I also saw the same thing with Min. She eventually landed a very good job whose basis was taking kickbacks from buyers, and, you know, that was where most of her income came from. And she just saved an incredible amount of money over the past couple years. That's how things work. And if you want to survive there, that's what you do. So it's really striking to us as Americans to see this level and scope and the tentacles of corruption everywhere in the city.
Even though the girls work what we would, I think, generally believe to be horrendous hours and under terrible conditions, at least in your portrayal, they seem to be able to have a lot of fun. Is this true? And what do the girls typically do with their leftover income and their time off? It seems like they do almost a promenade up and down the streets.
Yeah.
They do what teenage girls do, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Definitely. I think that's one of the things people often notice when, after they've read, you know, these years of stories about the miseries and oppression in China, they come to China, they're like, oh, people are actually in a pretty good mood here, you know? And it's just like, you know, I think people are, you know, Chinese people, they've gone through a lot of really terrible things in the last century, and they're very pragmatic, and they know this is a pretty good time, and they want to get as much as they can and make their lives better, and there's a huge energy and general optimism in the place that it's very hard to imagine if you're just reading stories about it. So I definitely felt like, you could see this among these young people in the factory towns. In terms of leisure time, it was interesting because that was one of the things they had to learn. You know, I mean, leisure time is sort of, you could say it's kind of a middle-class luxury, right? Because, you know, on the farm, they'll just work, they'll work when they need to work on the farm, and then other times they'll, you know, just hang around with the family or watch TV, or there isn't that much to do in the village. But in the city, suddenly they had all these opportunities. So sometimes I would spend time with these young women on the weekends, and, you know, they would go to the park, and but they didn't really know, they didn't want to spend any money on anything, so they would like go to the mall and just wander around and look at things, or go to the park and just look at things but not pay to get into anything, or just, you know, sit on the grass and talk, and, you know, like you said, kind of what teenage girls do everywhere.
You write of a sort of a fusion of rural folk life and big city living. Folk remedies are still used when people get sick. And certainly there's an obedience to the parents, at least at first, by sending money home and mm-hmm. coming home during the Lunar New Year and things like that, which is mm-hmm. very much Confucianism. Will this hold, or will the rural culture just drift away over time?
Well, I think that, you know, as you say, it's a mix, and I think it will continue to be a mix. You know, I think these young women go to the city, and they become in many ways modern. They start saving money for themselves. They start dating who they want to date, never mind what their parents think. But at the same time, as you say, their ties to their family are still quite strong, and they'll often still continue to send money home and feel very responsible to their parents and their younger siblings to take care of them. And as you say, they have a lot of, you know, they can be at once very modern, you know, wanting to get a driver's license and buy a car, for example, and on the other hand, very traditional in terms of, you know, the foods they eat at different times of the year, the things to help you, you know, if you want to stave off respiratory infection, you should eat pork lung and, you know, all these old wives types things that are still very strong inside them. So I think that it's not such an either-or thing. You know, I think it will continue. People will continue to move to the cities and learn these modern ways, and yet in many ways they're still quite traditional. And one example is that Min, the younger woman I write about, she recently got engaged, and she's going to get married and have a baby, and she's, you know, she's 21 years old. So it's not like, of course, this doesn't happen to everyone. And Chunming, the older woman I write about, is still unmarried at the age of, you know, 36, which is very old for traditional China to be unmarried. But, you know, I think in many cases, people are still behaving in quite traditional ways at the same time that they're living in a very modern, advanced city.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind our listeners that this interview was recorded earlier in the week with Leslie T. Cheng. And we will not be taking calls this morning as you hear us. You write that the girls were prey to all sorts of cons. There's all kinds of these self-improvement instructors that hang out a shingle, these gurus that will teach English and etiquette, and it sounds like they're just peeling off pages off the internet or, you know, Googling different topics, and they come out very funny when they're actually taught. Can you talk about, there's a couple of memorable ones. There's Mr. Wu and Teacher Fu. Can you talk about what role these teachers play in the lives of these girls?
Yeah, there's a huge self-help, self-education movement going on in these factory towns like Dongguan. And many of the young women I met had taken classes at evening schools to learn computers or try to learn English or learn etiquette. So one of the schools that I visited over a course of 3 months, which was one semester, was called the White Collar Educational Class. And it was basically aimed at girls working on the assembly line who wanted to move into white collar middle class, meaning, you know, secretary or clerk type work. So it was fascinating because, as you say, you know, a lot of what they taught was just total, you know, just like if you wear purple, people will think you're mysterious, like these bizarre, God knows where they found these things, you know. But at the same time, you know, they also imparted real skills, like here's how to present yourself at a job interview, you know, here's how to basically lie about your credentials so you can look qualified and get the job. And, you know, most of the young women, by the end of the three-month course, had, through the skills they learned in this course, jumped into what they called white-collar work, which is sort of the lowest level of office work, you know, being a secretary or being a clerk or being a sales assistant. But then from there, they could hopefully, you know, once you've got your foot on the rung, then you can gradually move up from there. The other very bizarre school that I ended up writing about was called Assembly Line English, and this was a very strange enterprise started by a man named Mr. Wu, whom Chunming introduced me to. And she said, oh, there's a school called Assembly Line English, and they promised that within 1 year you can speak English like an American fifth grader. And I was like, oh, okay, I have to see this, you know. And I thought Assembly Line English must be some sort of metaphor, you know. But then when I went to the classroom, it was basically all these students sitting at these tables while these machines moved past, like assembly lines, and on these machines were listed English words. And they would just read out the word over and over as it went by. And I only realized later that they didn't understand what this word meant at all, and they wouldn't learn what it meant for months. You know, they would basically be reciting these words for months before they even learned what it meant. And this was part of Mr. Wu's idea that, you know, this is the way to activate the eyeballs and the brain. And he had this really complicated theory about the biology and the, you know, physiology of the body and how this would help you learn English. And it was all based on the working schedule, you know, the labor law, which was, you know, work 4 hours, study 4 hours, have lunch, take a nap, study 4 more hours, have lunch, have dinner, take a nap, and then study 3 more hours overtime, and then go to sleep, you know. So, but again, you know, even though this was kind of this totally bizarre, wrong-headed way to learn a language, you know, while I was visiting that school that day, I met a young woman named Liu Yixia, who had spent a year kind of sleeping on the floor in a room behind the assembly line English school and studying every day, and she spoke to me in English, you know, and it wasn't great English, but she was speaking it and she was communicating with me, and this was very, very different from the traditional student in a Chinese classroom, even in a Chinese college, who might have taken years and years of English but is just terrified to even say a word because everything they've learned is on paper and nothing is actually functional and spontaneous, you know. So it was kind of an interesting mix, you know, where these ideas were just often wrongheaded and very strange and distorted coming from the outside world, and yet if you're very motivated, you can actually learn something and change your life because of it.
I think Mr. Wu would do fine in the United States. Maybe he could team up with Tony Robbins. But anyway, there's a parallel story in your book, which is just as compelling. It's your own story, your own family story, your family roots in China. You visit your ancestral village in 2005. What propelled you to leave the Washington or the Wall Street Journal reporting, not in the first person, and go into a sense of a memoir within this book?
Yeah. It was originally kind of serendipitous. I had taken an unpaid book leave from the Wall Street Journal to report more intensively on the migrant story. And because I was no longer going to the office every day, I had more free time, and I decided to visit my ancestral village in northeastern China, which is where my grandfather had gone out at the age of 16 to go to school in Beijing and then to go to America and then eventually go back to China. And so I visited this village, and I started learning more about my grandfather's story. And I realized that there were kind of parallels in the sense that, you know, when he was growing up, it was sort of the turn of the 20th century. China was just sort of awakening from this long period of isolation and trying to figure out, you know, how to interact with the Western world. And young people like my grandfather were also figuring out, you know, how do I become a modern person? You know, he learned English and he changed his name and he went abroad to study. And, you know, I found that there were a lot of parallels to this era in Chinese history where, again, you have China that's sort of opening up to the world and all these young people are wondering, how do I fit in? How can I become a modern person and not be left behind? So I thought it would be a really, you know, hopefully a powerful way to sort of dig deeper into Chinese history and to show that, you know, to put this historical moment that we're living through now in some context. Because one of the things about being in Dongguan was it feels historyless, like there's no past. People never spoke about the past, the Cultural Revolution, you know, Communist Party, not even, you know, it just felt like everything was happening moment to moment. But, you know in China that that's not true. There is a past that's happened, often a very traumatic one that's under the surface. And to not tell that story felt like it was leaving too much out. So I ended up sort of interspersing my own family story and my discovery of it with the story of these young migrants in the present.
And you write that learning my family changed the way I saw the factory towns of the South. And I think those two stories do come together very well in the book.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it was not a natural or obvious connection. You know, it wasn't like my grandmother worked in a factory as a migrant, you know, because, you know, my grandfather came from an educated family, and so his life path was very different. But, you know, I do think that part of the reason that people in China now, not just Dongguan, but across the country, are so pragmatic and so focused on the moment to moment I think is explained by the traumatic history that came before. You know, people are really determined to try to make their lives better because they know that life wasn't always like this, and maybe life will not always be like this. You know, maybe this is the one time there will be an opportunity and I'd better grab it, you know. So, yeah, sort of understanding the family history made me sort of be able to delve into more of the trauma of the recent past that I feel like is kind of hidden under the surface.
And speaking of China's history, this new generation, these factory girls, where does Chairman Mao fit into this, all this, into their thinking? How relevant is he? How relevant is his legacy to these girls?
Oh, very little. I mean, I have a Chairman Mao story from each of the girls, but they're both very surprising, maybe. The younger woman, Min, I was talking with her one time with a couple of older men from her factory, and the men were talking about what life was like under Chairman Mao in the 70s, and they said, "I was always hungry. I didn't stop being hungry until 1980. And Min suddenly turned to me and said, "Who is Chairman Mao now? I don't even know." Hmm. And I said, "You know, it's Hu Jintao, you know, that's the president of China." And she said, "Oh, I thought it was Jiang Zemin, but, you know, then I heard that he was dead already." And I said, "No, he's still alive. He's just retired." And she said, "Well, these things have nothing to do with me, you know." That was the only time she ever mentioned Chairman Mao or basically anything about politics, and that seemed very telling. And the older woman, Chun Ming, I went with her once to a Hunan restaurant, and there was this portrait of Chairman Mao on the wall, and she said, "Oh, do you know about our Chairman Mao?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." What do you think about him? And she said, "Oh, he was a great poet, and, you know, when he wanted to marry, he chose this actress that he really loved, and he could have chosen someone else who helped his political career, but he chose this woman because he really loved her, and he really did what he wanted to in life, you know."
Wow.
And I realized that she'd sort of recreated Chairman Mao as a kind of, you know, hero of individual will and totally distorted from, you know, any sort of historical knowledge we have of what Chairman Mao represents.
What are the conditions for foreign reporters in China? Can you travel at will without a minder? Can citizens talk to you openly without fear of retribution? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that's changing a lot. You know, technically, if you're a reporter and you leave your place where you're based, you're supposed to get approval to do any interviews or to go anywhere. But the reality is that that's not really observed anymore. And in fact, I think some of those rules have also changed during the Olympic coverage, and there's been talk that it's going to be made permanent. In terms of average people talking to you, I mean, that's also changed a lot, I'd say, in the last decade. You know, if you're doing a very sensitive story, it's still sensitive. It's still, you know, people might get in trouble if you're covering, you know, a protest at a factory and you talk to three of the ringleaders and use their names, like, they're going to get into trouble. They're probably going to get detained or fired or whatever. But, you know, most of the stories I did, even when I was working at the Journal, were not of that type, so people in general are pretty comfortable. In terms of Dongguan, I never really ran into that. You know, again, I think that was partly because this place is so not official and there's so little presence of government, but I never felt like people were scared to talk to me. I mean, what they are scared about more is that you're going to steal their business secrets and start a factory and compete with them, you know. But, you know, again, it's all economic. There's no sort of political fear anymore. Mm-hmm.
These girls are so ambitious and they talk constantly about self-improvement. Freedom means what to a young woman in China? Where do they believe their ambition will take them?
Yeah, freedom, that's a good question. Freedom means, a lot of freedom means having the things they want, you know. I think that's sort of the first thing, is having a nice apartment, having a car, having a child, and being able to educate the child the way you want it to be educated. That's sort of the first level. But then I think, you know, then you get beyond the purely material concerns. And then, you know, I think people have very different ideas and they're searching for different things. You know, Chun Ming often talked with me about, you know, what would make her happy. And she said, you know, I've read that freedom is doing what you want when you want, and I'm not there yet, you know. And for her, freedom was a more abstract thing about being able to travel or being able to do the thing she loved. And, you know, she hadn't really achieved that yet. So it's, you know, it's very personal. It's not at all a sense of you know, rights and the political system, voting, you know, these things never came up in my conversations with the migrants. You know, for them it was a very personal sense of, you know, I want to go to America, or I want to learn English, or I want to you know, start a little bookstore and where you can sell, you know, trimming. This was one of her dreams, have a little bookstore where you could serve coffee and nice books, you know, and that's really what their vision of freedom is. I think it's very different from what we might expect, you know, coming from a political Western point of view.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful documentary, you've probably seen it, called Mardi Gras, where workers in China are making Mardi Gras beads, and they don't know where the beads are going. And, mm-hmm. and then the documentary filmmaker goes to New Orleans and interviews people wearing the beads and asks them, do you know where they come from? Is there that sense in these manufacturing factories that the workers know where their goods are going?
Yeah, I'd actually not seen that documentary. I've heard about it from many mm-hmm. different people. One thing that is true is I feel like the workers are very removed from the products that they make. And that was one striking thing, was that when you talk to a worker about their factory, they would never tell you anything about the products unless you specifically asked. And then they would say something really vague, like, oh, it's a part that's in a phone. Oh, well, what part? Oh, it's like, you know, I don't know what it's called. You know, like, that wasn't their concern at all. It was really, you know, how much money am I making? Is this a good job? What can I do next? How do I move up from here? So I found that Mardi Gras thing is a little bit maybe a little bit misleading, because I just didn't think the workers were that invested in, mm-hmm. in their products or what they meant to begin with. You know, I mean, they know they're going overseas and that's about it. And, you know, I guess it is deflating to know that you're making a product that someone's just throwing off the side of a float and then just basically disappearing, you know. But you know, my sense from the workers was that they never really felt that invested in what they were making to begin with.
Mm-hmm. How is all this female empowerment, this emptying of rural areas, changing China, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really changing the view of women in rural China, you know, and I saw this very clearly with Min, the younger woman, when she went home to her village for the Chinese New Year. You know, a lot of people in the village would say things like, you know, it's much better to have a daughter than a son now, because daughters get jobs in factories and they send home more money, you know. Mm-hmm. So in the old days it was, you know, sons are more valuable because they can work on the farm. And, you know, I think a lot of these ideas are changing. You know, I think that, you know, I think it's a mix. Like I said, I think that, you know, these young women are finding a lot of power in their newfound economic freedom and personal freedoms, but at the same time they still do feel traditional in many ways. As I said, you know, the younger woman Min, who's just getting married and having a family now, you know, I think they still feel a lot of traditional responsibilities and expectations still in place.
Mm-hmm. The book is called Factory Girls. We're talking with Leslie T. Chang. It's Factory Girls: From Village to City in a Changing China. Spiegel and Grau are the publishers. I think I pronounced that correctly. What are you working on next?
Oh, I'm thinking about some ideas. I'd like to do some more pieces in China, and then I'd gradually like to turn my attention to America. I live in a small town in southwestern Colorado with my husband. And
Durango?
Not too far from Durango, okay. A couple hours north. Mm-hmm. It's called, yeah, it's a little town.
Okay.
But you know, I think it's there are a lot of untold stories in America as well, and we're looking forward to kind of focusing on those.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, Leslie. Leslie T. Chang, again, the book is Factory Girls: From Village to City in a Changing China, and I thank you again for your time. It was a pleasure to speak with you, and I wish you best of luck with all your endeavors from here on out.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank
Bye.
You.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to stop by for Krannert Uncorked, a weekly wine tasting complemented by relaxing music and free cheese and crackers. More information is at krannertcenter.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Wheat futures are showing some positive gains today. erasing a lower open due to some short covering. We're also seeing that today that gold briefly was rallying above $750 as the funds are weighing in and buying some of hard commodities like gold. Meanwhile, over in the corn and soybean pits, we're seeing a little bit of a softer tone today. And let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat at 586 is up 8, now up 7.5 at 585.5. March, $6.5, up 7.5. December wheat at the Board of Trade, 548.75, up 10.5. March, 568.75, up 10. May, 583.25, up 9.75. July, 596.75, up 9. December corn, 375 down 2. March, 391.5 down, now 392 down 1.5. May, 403.5 down 1.25. July, 414.75 down 1.25. December of 2009, 437.25 down 3. November beans, 879.25 down 7.75. January, 887.25 down 6.75. March, 896.5 down 6.5. May, 907.75 down 5.5. November, 913 down 5. December soybean meal, 264.40 up 40. January, 265.40 up 30. December soybean oil, 32.33 down 48. And